Last chapter, we presented the first self-force calculations ever done with 3 plus 1 codes. And, but the limitation of the result last year was that it could only work for circular orbits, because at the time, we only had an effective source that was good for circular orbits. And as promised, I promised in the last CAPRA that by this CAPRA, I'd have something that would work for generic orbits. And at the end of the talk, the whole talk is basically going to say that I've delivered on that promise. So just to set the context again, remind us of what the context for this work is. A few years ago, Steve introduced this idea of performing self-force calculations by essentially reversing the traditional way in which a self-force is computed. And this is goes by how I'd like to call it that we regularize first before we actually evolve. As opposed to the way it's typically done, where we solve for a formally divergent retarded field and then perform a regularization afterwards in order to compute for a self-force. At the end of the day, the set of equations that we propose numerical relativists to solve is this simultaneous. The simultaneous set of equations, which involve one that governs a field, which is a typical wave equation, and one which governs the particle dynamics. And you notice that this is coupled by the fact that, what drives the evolution of the wave is essentially the dynamics of the particle. And what drives the particle dynamics, of course, is what the self-force is. The self-force here is, of course, nothing but the gradient of this field that we're ultimately going to be solving. Now, the chief advantage of this, and which is the primary motivation for introducing this technique, was that it really is a non-post-processing approach to self-consistent evolution. If you had some method of solving this simultaneously, then the natural output is a psi-r, which, when evaluated at the wave zone, really is going to give you what you want, which is the retarded field, the physical retarded field. Of course, the question there is, what this psi-r is. The other chief advantages, of course, are that, the method does not inherently depend on any underlying symmetries of the space-time in question, and it will take full advantage of existing numerical relativity infrastructure that's pretty well developed at this point. Of course, there are disadvantages to it. One is that, based on our experience last year, it invariably leads to lower accuracy compared to the extremely accurate and more sophisticated methods that have been developed for over a decade. And finally, that inherits all the difficulties that one would typically encounter in any kind of 3 plus 1 calculation. It's just more complicated. All right, so crucial to this approach, this whole approach, is the capacity to actually compute this thing called an effective source. And formally, the way we express it is by essentially doing this. The elements that go into an effective source are, something we call a window function, which is something that we pick according to these restrictions here. And if you want to know what they are, you can just ask me afterwards. But this is something that's arbitrarily chosen. There are a variety of choices that you can make. And the goal, the chief function of the window function is to essentially compactify the effective source and guarantee that if you evaluate whatever it is that you're evolving at the wave zone, it becomes really what you're interested in, which is the physical retarded field. And then the crucial thing, which is what was lacking for, in the last time we presented this, results on this, is an accurate enough explicit approximation to the exact Detweiler singular field written in the background coordinates. And this was something we only had this. And as an example, in THZ coordinates, for instance, this is what the expression for the singular field looks like. It's nothing but q over rho, where rho is nothing but the ordinary x squared plus y squared plus z squared in THZ coordinates. But of course, all the complexities of this are hidden in the fact that x, y, and z here are functions of the background coordinates, and these functions are non-trivial. Although I have to say that we have done this to the appropriate order, we just haven't found a way to actually write it down in a clean and compelling fashion. But the point is, again, to just emphasize the point from this slide, we need to find an approximation to psi s for a generic orbit, for a scalar charge moving in a generic orbit of a Schwarzschild background, in terms of the background coordinates. That was the goal. It denotes approximate from the exact one. So once things without tildes are the exact. So here, this is the exact one, whereas this would be the tilde. So the new element to why this was successful, why it was successful now, was a new starting point, which basically takes off from work by Roland and Eric. And So the idea was, well, so this expression for the singular field obviously isn't unique. There is a covariant expression for the singular field for a scalar charge. And what they've been able to do in this work back in 2006 was actually find a very convenient way of expressing it in terms of the background coordinates, and it goes in a sequence of steps. Well, the way I'm showing you, the form I'm showing you here is the first step that they do, which is to express psi s in terms of five scalar functions, five because I truncated to the appropriate order, so I really just really am only interested in everything up to order epsilon squared, where epsilon is a measure of distance away between the field and the field point and the point at the location of the charge. And so basically they have what they have is psi s written in these in terms of these five convenient scalar functions. So let me just explain a little bit about the elements that go into this. Well, as all of you might know, R and R advanced theory are nothing really but affine parameter distances between the knowledge you're connecting, for example, x and the advanced point x double prime. And whereas that would be R advanced, and R would be the affine parameter distance connecting between the knowledge you that connects the x and x prime. And the difference between and the quantities here that you see, where you see us, where you see sigma bars, for example, there. This is nothing but the tangent vector. It's not a tangent vector, basically. That the tangent vector to this curve here, which is basically a spatial geodesic connecting x and x bar, which is an arbitrarily chosen point between x prime and x double prime. So this is still a covariant expression. So at this point, you have two choices, whether to, because as you notice, the goal here is to compute box of psi tilde s. I propose that we use this as psi tilde s. Another goal is to compute psi tilde s, or box psi tilde s, rather. And so now you have two choices. Do you proceed covariantly, or do you automatically put in background coordinates and then just use partial derivatives to compute the Dalin version of this thing? I've actually pursued both, but I failed in one, and Barry's going to show you more success in the other approach that I didn't quite make much progress in. But what I used instead was what I've done instead was express what you see here in terms of background coordinates, which are also provided by Haas and by Roland and Eric in their work. And so they were able to express this. The sigma alpha bar, which is really the key entity that appears in this. So notice that the only thing that all of these things depend on, or where x really explicitly comes in, is in the sigma alpha bars. And so they've been able to express this as an expansion in the coordinate distance or displacements, right? And that's pretty convenient. And so where they derive all these coefficients here, and all these coefficients are not are quantities that are evaluated where the charge is. So the point of this then is that with the two slides that I showed you, we really have a perfectly legitimate generic singular field in terms of the background coordinates, albeit it's rather complicated. But this is something that's perfectly doable with MAPLE. It's exactly what's done. So I'll say a little bit about why I stopped with the covariant approach. And this is where Barry actually was successful and I wasn't. So in the covariant approach, you begin with essentially this, and you compute that, and you try to not use the background coordinates for as long as possible. In my experience, this has always required truncation of higher order terms. I mean, I've been able to get to the point where I've actually seen the cancellation of the divergences, but I couldn't quite get the term that I wanted to be able to get me a nice clean expression. But my worry was that these truncations, as explained on the next slide, would somehow break this key relation that was fundamental in this whole approach. And then the beauty about using background coordinates in the way I thought about this before was that, well, once you commit to a coordinate system and once you write down the singular field approximation in that coordinates, when you take the Dalin version of that, you don't really have to give up anything. It's just one big messy thing, but it's all there. So this is kind of what I've been talking to Barry for a long time, for quite a bit, and I would like to get some clarification on whether it's correct or not. And the idea here is, well, suppose we start, recall the sort of the effect, the effective wave equation, if you want, where I've now expanded the effective source this way, and focus on the one that's in red. In deriving a nice covariant expression for this box, that's usually what that's what I wanted before. And suppose we find it, and suppose we say, you know, it's f sigma, so it's not a nice thin expression in terms of sigma. And so, you know, the full box IS is going to be some f sigma plus some term that I don't really know because I just throw it out. So this is kind of like an error term. Now, what would happen if I used f sigma instead of the full box IS? So I'd use this and run this, you know, with a 3 plus 1 code, say. So instead of using the full thing, I'm actually going to use this instead because this is a nicer expression. And so now you run your code here, and it solves for psi bar. And my question is, well, before, my confusion was, how is this related to what you would get if you actually put in the full thing? Okay. And so basically, so that's the question. And well, you can basically just find that by, you know, subtracting the two equations. And you see that the difference between these two solutions is going to be something. Yeah, it's going to be a solution to the wave equation that's sourced by this thing. And the question is, like, if the source vanishes, does it necessarily mean that these two actually vanishes on the word line? So I think in general that might not be true, but I think in the way Barry Pickle is doing it, it might. So it might not be a problem.
I think it would be very surprising if it were true.
Well, I think the key thing is that they don't have a window function. So this is one, and you now have something that's just expressed in terms of sigma, which might be a box of some. Well, we can discuss this because I don't have enough time. So anyway, that's the main thing. So anyway, just speeding things along, what I've done instead was use the coordinates, and I found this packaging of the expression. This is really messy. This way of packaging the singular field expression is particularly convenient. So in the way I'm putting this up in Maple, then I write the singular field in terms of these eight big polynomials in the coordinate displacements. I compute the heck out of all of them, all the partial derivatives, and essentially I get this gigantic mess, which thanks to the C code generation facility just made my life a lot easier. So this involved nothing, just 72 new functions. They were very long and nasty. But again, thanks to Maple and to this option, which I have to thank Roland for. But it's done. It's done. And again, here, an important thing to stress is that nothing here is specific to Schwarzschild or Kerr. So I've done it for Schwarzschild. Barry has done it for Kerr. And so I think it should be pretty straightforward to proceed. I just want to say this last point. An important issue that arises because you get these gigantic mess of terms, and that it turns out that when you're evaluating the effective source very close to the particle, you get this subtraction between very, very large numbers, which invariably leads to inaccuracies. And so I basically implemented an interpolation scheme that takes advantage of the fact that we really know what the effective source is formally at the location of the charge. And so I simply do what I call a coordinate ray interpolation. So I basically use points outside a certain region where I believe the effective source calculation. And then I make use of that single data point at the particle location and just basically interpolate along. And so I'll show you some results. This is what would typically result without the interpolation, the one with the points on them. So as you see, as you get closer, it gets really, really horrible. But then with interpolation, it gets you this nice, correct behavior. It basically just kills off the noise. So basically, I'm tracing along a ray here where the charge is. So basically, the charge is really right there. If I go deviate slightly away from it, then you still get this noisy behavior. But the interpolation mitigates it somewhat. And finally, you get something even better as you go further away. And this is what the effective source looks like. I mean, you've seen this like two kappas before, so you've seen in every kappa since. This is again for a circuit orbit, but this was computed. I need to emphasize this with the generic orbit code, and it looks kind of the same as before. I haven't compared this with what we got from the THG code yet. I didn't have enough time, but it's done. And so the take-home message then is essentially the following: that I now have C code that really computes the effective scalar charge moving along a generic geodesic of Schwarzschild. The promise is that curves to follow quickly. Interpolation seems to effectively mitigate the problems that we encounter close to the particle location. And with Peter's very good 3+1 code, self-consistent evolution for a scalar point charge should be doable very, very soon. Thank you for attention.
What would it take to generalize this to generic non-geodesic trajectories?